Good talking to you.
Good afternoon. Monday, February 21st, opening the House Committee on Water. Item on our agenda is a public hearing on House Bill 2170. What's this one all about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2170 is legislation that the interim subcommittee on water introduced at the request of the Ballast Water Task Force. This incorporates some of their, or all of their recommendations that, not all of them, excuse me, most of the recommendations that they outlined in their report. It modifies provisions relating to ballast water management. It revises the definition of open sea exchange and coastal exchange. It specifies that open sea or coastal exchange must occur through flow through or empty and refill exchanges. It requires owners or operators of vessels to keep ballast water management logs and maintain the ballast water management plan. And it's creating the task force on ballast water management without a sunset. This does have a prior reference or a sub-referral to Ways and Means when the committee chooses to take any action on it. I have attached the executive summary of the report to the SMS, just so folks have it in front of them for review. But I do believe that the full report is available on a web page, and I will get that address to you if the gentlemen don't have it with them today.
Okay, fine. Pat, are you coming in? Okay, would you please? Mark and Sebastian. Your names for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Sitzma. I'm an associate professor of environmental science at Portland State University. And during the interim, I chaired the Oregon Ballast Water Task Force and also the Oregon Invasive Species Council during the interim. The Ballast Water Task Force prepared a report to the legislature that we submitted last October that summarized international, federal, California, and Washington activities on regulation and management of ballast water to prevent introduction of invasive species. And this bill, House Bill 2170, addresses some of the key recommendations from that report. Not all of the recommendations, but the ones that were deemed by the task force to probably be the most critical. One of the primary goals of many of us working on invasive species associated with shipping over the past few years has been trying to develop uniform regulations for shipping to regulate ballast water throughout the West Coast. In the past, we've had differing regulations in each state, and I think finally we're at a point where all the states are kind of lining up and developing common regulations. So those uniform regulations should allow shipping industry compliance to be easier and more readily understood what the regulations are, and that, of course, should then enhance our ability to prevent introductions.
Mark, is British Columbia included in this Western states?
British Columbia has been at the various meetings that we've had to discuss common regulations. It's
okay.
A different situation in British Columbia, obviously. It's
yes,
a federal Canadian program rather than a provincial program, so it's less easy for them to manipulate the regulations.
Okay, thank you.
Probably the most important provision of House Bill 2170 are in Section 4, which modifies the coastal exchange requirement for ships coming from domestic coasts on the west coast. In the past, the Oregon law has required ships to do an exchange south of 40 degrees north latitude, which is about Point Mendocino if they're coming north, say from San Francisco Bay, or north of 50 degrees north latitude, which is about the northern tip of Vancouver Island, if they're coming south along the coast. That's different than Washington route requirements, which is a 50 nautical mile offshore requirement. And recently, California's proposed a rule that would move to a 50 nautical mile requirement as well. So one of the key things we would like to do in this bill is to modify the coastal exchange requirement, move away from this latitude designation, and adopt the 50 nautical mile and 200 meter depth criterion that other states are using on the West Coast. That would bring us into sort of a harmony with the other states and make compliance by the shipping industry much simpler. And probably, as an aside, be as or more protective of Oregon waters than our current requirements based on latitude. This sort of joint 50 nautical mile program for various states has been developed through various meetings of the Pacific Ballast Water Group, which includes industry, academics, and regulators from all the states on the West Coast. Section 5 of the bill provides a definition of exchange that was lacking previously in our law, specifies exactly what an exchange means. Washington State has had a similar designation in their law for many years, and they found that ships occasionally do partial exchanges, which wouldn't be as protective as a full exchange. So we wanted to have some language in there so that we would be able to know whether or not ships have done a full exchange or a partial exchange when they're coming into Oregon. And this language that defines what an exchange is the same as the Coast Guard rules currently used for how to define what an exchange is. Section 6 just clarifies when ballast water reports must be submitted. And again, we've adopted the same language the Coast Guard uses, so we're all uniform in our requirements about when ships have to report and where, that sort of thing. Section 3 of the bill reconstitutes the Ballast Water Task Force, and I believe it does have a sunset. I have to look at it to check that, but I think it's sunsetted. At the end of 2006, I think, right before the next Legislative Assembly meets. And the task force is really there to provide updates to the legislature on what's happening. This ballast water management is still a very fluid subject, and changes in the science of ballast water biology and treatment technologies are continuing. It's our hope, though, that the regulations and our current with this amendment are in a form that can accommodate any future changes in the science, and that future action by the legislature won't be necessary. But of course, it's difficult to predict, and some further modification to Oregon law might be required in the future. And that's really the purpose of the task force, is to provide a report to the legislature updating you on what's going on in terms of ballast water management to prevent invasive species introductions. PSU produced and is currently implementing the Invasive Species Management Plan. We get some grant funding from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to implement this plan. And in the past, we've used that funding to support the task force and to write the report. We anticipate that funding will continue, so we're perfectly happy to continue to assist the task force and produce a report to the legislature in 2006. Lastly, Section 2 was inserted in the bill mainly to maintain uniformity with Coast Guard and California requirements. Since those requirements are really the same as the Coast Guard, I understand that amendments have been submitted that would delete Section 2. It's really redundant with federal requirements, and ships are going to be doing that anyway, so the thought was there's probably not necessary for Oregon to have that codified in statute. Again, the bill, as it stands right now, has been vetted with the Oregon Ballast Water Task Force, and we've also discussed the proposed amendments to leaving Section 2. There was another small change, and I have to look it up, in terms of the definition of what a coastal exchange is. I think we said somewhere in here, we define a common waters is between 40 and 50 degrees north latitude. So a ship, say, from Coos Bay doesn't have to do an exchange if it's coming to the Columbia River. The language we have is if those common waters are between 40 and 50 degrees north latitude, but we didn't consider the fact, well, there's another 40 and 50 degrees north latitude on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. So technically, the way the law is written now, a ship from northern Japan could come and discharge ballast water without an exchange. So another amendment that's been submitted is to modify that, just to say the common waters designation. It's 40 to 50 degrees north latitude on the west coast of North America, or some language to that effect.
Excuse me, that amendment has been submitted to LC at this point?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate all the hard work that you've done in this, and I read the report this summer, and I found it really fascinating because I actually was not that familiar with our ballast exchange regulations. One question I have is, in your executive summary from the report on the bottom, the last paragraph, you talk about Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife provided the data to assess compliance with Oregon law. Can you talk a little bit more about the compliance record and the fact that there was a high number of noncompliance and how we can work to prevent that in the future? And I noted that at the end of that paragraph, you said that a decline in staffing has led to a decline in compliance, which is certainly understandable. So what can we do to try to increase the compliance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder.
Or increase the compliance, I'm sorry.
Yeah, increase compliance. That would be good. In the past, there's no funding has been provided to DEQ to implement this program. So the first year of the program, I had a graduate student at Portland State, maintained a database and tracked all the reports. The second year of the program, that student was gone. I didn't have the funding to support another student to do that. So Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife took over logging the data and tracking the ballast water reporting forms. So not having somebody present on the ground locally to sort of chase down missing forms and make corrections on the forms if there's something that's illegible on the form, that's really been a problem in terms of compliance. The ship's compliance rates drops when you don't have somebody calling them and knocking on the door reminding them they need to send a report in. So we're fortunate that Washington State had a program in place and they did their best to include the data. One of the comments in the report is that our judgment of what happened in the last year of the ballast water program is limited by the data we have available, which is what Washington provided us. What we can do about it, it would be wonderful if the state could actually fund a program and fund a position or half a position in DEQ to maintain this program. In the short run, what we're doing at PSU is a joint program with the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, which runs the National Ballast Information Clearinghouse. So all the ships that report to the Coast Guard, the data actually gets sent to the Smithsonian. We have a joint program with the Smithsonian now to develop a common database. So this is a grant-funded position that I have in my lab to fund a person to follow the ballast water reports as they come in to Oregon, communicates directly with the national database. So we're trying to work around the lack of state funding by actually using grant funds to support somebody that would add value to the national database as well as maintain the Oregon database on ballast water. So we're sort of working around it. Obviously, we can track the data forms and get them into a database, but there's PSU certainly doesn't have any enforcement capability, so that's still lacking. We can call DEQ and say we're missing a report, but if there's nobody there to sort of follow up on it, it's sort of limited effectiveness.
Just a follow-up. I apologize. It's sort of hard to compete with a marching band outside, so I'm trying to hear the best I can, but I appreciate that, and I certainly understand that you've been filling the gaps as far as what the role I think the state should be doing given our budget crisis here. Do you know if there's any opportunities for federal funding, either through the Coast Guard or through EPA, or look at joint funding with the state of Washington, because obviously they're funding a position or maybe more than one position? But and certainly, I think it's great that you've been able to help with the data collection, but you're right, it's not the responsibility of PSU to do enforcement. So do you have any suggestions on that front?
Well, the Washington program, Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, the Washington program has actually been funded with federal funds. I mean, there's not very much state money available, even in Washington, to go into this ballast water program. The only state on the West Coast that really has a state funding is California, and they have a program that charges fees on ships, and the fees go into running the program. We have, like I mentioned, we do get some federal funds for our invasive species management plan, so we're using those funds to sort of support the task force and run this. I think one of the problems is it's hard to get funding for an ongoing state program. We can get money to do projects, like, for example, the database project is a pilot project. We want to demonstrate that we can maintain this state-federal program, the common database, and what happens after that, once the pilot project is over, ideally, the Coast Guard would then support that and help maintain that program, but I don't know if that's actually going to happen. I think the pilot program will be a success. I'm sure we can do this, but what happens after that, I don't know. I think it's difficult to write a proposal to maintain a state program.
Thank you, Mark.
Representative Brown. Mark, do you use any of the talents that are at Hatfield Marine Science Center or at University of Oregon Marine Biology School at Charleston in any way?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brown, certainly we do. I've had co-PIs on research projects at Hatfield. John Chapman worked with me on a survey of the lower Columbia River for aquatic nuisance species in the past. That's a project, a two-year project that was actually Coast Guard funded that just finished last year. And we certainly take advantage of some of the teaching opportunities. I have a graduate student down at OM in Charleston right now taking courses down there. So we work sort of on an academic level and research level with those folks regularly.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mark? We would like to have those amendments rather soon if possible. So if you could let me know what the status or what you're anticipating the status of those, would appreciate it. Because obviously we don't want to move forward with that unintentional language there. Okay. Please, Sebastian.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sebastian Deegans. I work with the Port of Port of Portland, and I'm here today both as the manager of the Marine Planning and Development Department with the Port and as a task force member speaking in support of the amendments and the bill in front of you. I've provided some written testimony, and I'm not going to read that here for you today. Just wanted to summarize, really the Port of Portland has been in support of improved ballast water management for many years, and we were really proud to work on the original legislation in 2001. I think the intent, originally has always been that we would be working, we could not do improved ballast water management alone on the Oregon side. It would really need to be done in conjunction with the efforts that are underway both internationally, nationally, and with other states on the West Coast. So to the degree that the amendments in front of you today are intended to bring our program here in Oregon into greater harmony, I think is the right word here, with the efforts on the West Coast, we certainly support that. I think it's important to note that with the proliferation worldwide of ballast water management regulations, that it is, it's really significant. It's a significant advantage to the shipping coming here to have the rules be as similar to other places on the West Coast as possible. We think that will improve the reporting compliance. We know industry can do it. They did it the first year of our program here, and we fully expect that compliance will go up. The Coast Guard has put in place starting in September of this last year new regulations that require mandatory ballast water exchange, which has increased their focus on that. Unfortunately, I can't tell you today how that how effective that has been to date, but I think that's more information that we at the task force level would be taking into consideration in the future. We make recommendations to you in the future. Again, I think what's made ballast water management effective here has been the coalition or the cooperation between industry, Port of Portland, the Columbia River Steamship Operators, Portland State University, and putting a program together and helping to implement that together with DEQ, and we are proud to continue to be able to be participants in that.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I guess it's more of a comment.
Representative Dinkelberger.
Thank you. And I guess I'll follow on the question I asked Mark. And I know that's part of the recommendations that the task force came out with is funding a half-time position at DEQ. So any ideas that you might have and how we could fund that? Because my concern is you have a lot of great recommendations, but part of them are only going to be as good as we can do through one, education, which you've identified, but also enforcement. And not to say that I don't trust the shipping industry, but I think that if we're truly serious about the ballast water issue, which I know is a big issue, especially as we're getting more and more ships from Southeast Asia, that we need to make sure that we can figure out a way to fund the position, and certainly encourage you to be creative. As I'm sure you probably know, it's difficult to find funding through our general fund these days.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dinkfelder, I think you have a right to be concerned validly on that. It's been my belief that the industry has been doing a relatively good job in terms of actually performing exchanges, particularly on the international side. And with the mandatory exchange requirement that the Coast Guard will be in charge of inspecting, I think we can see compliance there in the reporting go up. Certainly if it does not, I think then you would be justified in moving forward with some more aggressive means to regulate the industry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Don't have anything. I did have a question, and I think we go back, Mark, to your testimony, and either or both of you are welcome to comment on this, but 2170 addresses key recommendations from the report, and as you indicated, there were some recommendations that were left out. What were those left out recommendations, if you can remember?
Mr. Chair, I can't remember all of them. There was quite a long list, but one of the recommendations, as Representative Dinkfelder mentioned, was that there should be somebody in charge of this program in the state. We recommended a half-time position at DEQ just to maintain enforcement. Obviously, there's fiscal impact of that recommendation. We need more research and more investigation of how to treat ballast water. I mean, ultimately, ballast water exchange is a short-term solution, and we need to move towards treatment. Funding available for research on treatment of ballast water is limited even at the federal level. So it'd be really nice if the state could put some money into finding a solution to this. So most of those recommendations that are left out are all things that are going to cost money and sometimes substantial amounts of money to actually move forward on that.
Mr. Chair, if I might add one item. We had quite a bit of discussion at the task force level about the impact of barges and other coastal activity. And frankly, if I might, one thing that the Oregon Ballast Water Program has put into place that the national program does not have is requirements for mandatory coastal exchange. Now, we have some geographic boundaries on that, but it's always been the task force's view that the primary areas of risk were as much from domestic ports outside of our area, where some of these species already are known to exist and have already established themselves. So the law today addresses the ballast water exchange from larger vessels in the commercial fleets, but not so much from tug and barge and other coastwise traffic. I think there we found that we really needed to do some more research on that. We didn't really have a full grasp of the actual tonnage involved and the methods of transfer, but that's something that we wanted to do more work on in the coming 2 years. So we had recommendations about more research, not necessarily an action at this point.
Thank you. I think that's important to have on our record here. And I think if I can elaborate for the committee a little bit on the domestic, seems to me we get some ship maybe on rare occasions from the San Francisco area, and I believe that they have a substantial invasive species have been introduced into the San Francisco Bay Area, species that we really aren't too anxious to have introduced into the Portland. The mitten crab, I think, is one of those that could have, you know, have pretty negative impact for us. It seems to me like, and this is an editorial comment, I guess, but it seems to me like this is an issue that has been just waiting to explode on us as a problem as far as invasive. There's more and more foreign shipping that we have, and of course we're out actively trying to be more involved in that. I mean, the very nature of much of our economy is dependent upon it, and the more of that happens, the more we're open to having some invasive exotic species introduced, and the cost of that might be much greater than anything that we could would do to prevent it. So I guess I certainly wouldn't hold any hope out, but for any kind of funding in this particular legislative year. But we're going to have to keep bringing that issue for funding back to the legislature, and maybe eventually enough of us will become aware of it that it will move up in the priority queue to where something can be effectively done with it. In the chair's opinion, it's a significant problem, and we do appreciate very much the work that you've done, and Mark, we especially appreciate your work on this over the past I think it's three biennium that I'm familiar with, and it must have gone on before that, so we appreciate your work and thank you for it, and we will be anxious to move this bill forward. We do need your amendments, though, to correct the one little problem that's there. And with that, are there any other questions for
me? I have one more, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Representative. Somehow I knew.
I knew. Well, and I know I read this somewhere, so I'm sort of taking this from something that I know I read, I think, in one of your information or maybe in the report. And Mark, I know right now that the West Coast, pretty much we do exchange programs, and the question I had that I thought I'd read somewhere about looking at new technologies, and are there other countries that you know of or other areas of the world where they actually are doing treatment, you know, UV or ozonation, versus just doing an exchange, which is basically the way we used to treat and still do, in a sense, some of our wastewater treatment. You know, it reminds me of just the dilution as the solution to pollution. So how long, far down the road, do you see that we might actually be treating or requiring treatment or encouraging treatment, however, versus doing exchanges? And or any other parts of the world doing that currently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, there's a lot of research going on treatment technologies. My understanding is, at this point, there's nothing really on the shelf ready to be installed on ships that works all the time everywhere and meets the discharge standards. One of the problems in the past is that there hasn't been a standard as a target for the treatment. So the International Maritime Organization has set a standard. It has to be adopted by, it's a treaty, so it has to be adopted by all the countries. There's movement in the U.S. by the Coast Guard to set standards, and once those standards are set, then it gives a target for treatment technology inventors to go at. That's coming, and it could be in the next few years we'll have the standards in place. Some of the technology vendors, they always say that we've got the answer, all we need is the standard. UV, for example, has had some problems on ships because when you put the UV treatment systems that have bulbs that generate the UV light on board a ship, it's a very hostile environment for a light bulb. And it starts vibrating around and they break and things like that. So the engineering, although it might work in a lab, when you go put it on a ship with this hostile environment, that things just sort of break down. So there is an ongoing research on how to treat. There are programs in place. We are hosting a workshop in June that will set the standard, will set sort of protocols for how to do onboard testing. In Florida, there's already a program in place for a facility in place for doing shoreside testing. So how you do experiments in the lab to tell whether or not this treatment stuff technology is going to work. We're having a workshop in June that would set protocols for how you do onboard treatment of ballast water treatment technology. So it's sort of an incremental process. The standards are in place, then you have the testing that goes on board ships to make sure that the equipment actually does what it's supposed to do and works every time. I hate to put a date on it, but I think probably 5 to 10 years before we really get treatment technologies installed on a large portion of the ships that are out there plying the oceans.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate
you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'd like to correct myself. I said that the task force was being placed into statute, and the reporting mechanism calls for them to report back to the legislature during the interim with the deadline of October 1, 2006, and it is sunsetted on the first day of the next legislative assembly, the task force is.
Thank you. Bob Danko with DEQ. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. We just want to go on record of thanking Mr. Sitzma and the Port of Portland. We have a good team approach on this, and we've already talked about the resources. And without those resources, the team approach is critical to working on this issue. And also want to go on record, the department supports the bill and the amendments that will come forward.
Thank you, Bob. A little disappointed. I thought maybe you were coming to tell us that the department had the resources and was going to devote the personnel needed to this in order to be able to make it carry it out effectively. But
I wish I could, Mr. Chair, but I can't bring that message.
We'll wait, for the next session then to answer that question. Thank you very kindly. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to offer any public comment on House Bill 2170, modified provisions relating to ballast water? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2170, and we will open an informational session with the Water Resource Department reporting on their activities under the Oregon Plan during the biennium. And we have Debbie Colbert and Phil Ward. And I think it must be nice to be a director of an agency, because every time the director of an agency comes to report before a legislative committee, they always bring their brains with them from the department to keep them out of trouble. So
glad to have you both with us. And it looks like Debbie's going to run the team, and we're off. And for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record,
it is very nice. And my name is Phil Ward with the Department of Water Resources. However, though, Debbie is negotiating with me some time for time for this holiday day that she's spending with us today. Mr. Chair, Debbie is the primary steward of our Oregon Plan measures, and we're happy today to give you a bit of a look in terms of what we do relative to the Oregon Plan. So with that, I'll turn it over to her. I'll have a couple brief comments here and there. But Debbie, why don't you go ahead?
Okay.
I thought there was a statute someplace that trumped all collective bargaining agreements that public employees had as far as, you know, coming to legislative committees when the legislature was in session. Apparently, if there wasn't, maybe we'd better advance one of that type.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Welcome, Debbie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm very glad to be here today to tell you about our Oregon Plan measures and some of our activities under the Oregon Plan. Again, for the record, my name is Debbie Colbert, and I'm with the Water Resources Department.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Colbert.
I just have to say, your last name's Colbert? Colbert. Oh, I thought it was Colbert. I thought, boy, that's really that's too close for comfort to have somebody at the water department with the last name Colbert. I was going to say, Phil, you're too, that was too clever. Before I walk through our Oregon Plan measures, I wanted to first tell you about the strategy that we've used for kind of focusing our limited staff resources to get the greatest benefit to watersheds. And so what I have up here is actually a series of three maps, just as an example of the process that we went through jointly with ODFW starting in about 1997. And I'm using the Rogue Basin as our example basin. And what you see here, the first map in the upper left corner is has the shades of red and brick. Those are flow restoration needs. And these were based on biological criteria. ODFW identified areas within each basin that either had a very low need for flow restoration or had the absolute highest need for flow restoration, and those are the dark brick color areas in this example in the Rogue. And they based this their ranking on biological criteria like the presence or absence of fish, potential for restoration, overall risk of survival to fish species in the basin. Meanwhile, our field staff did an assessment of the opportunities for flow restoration from the standpoint of existing water rights and water that was be available to do flow restoration. And this is shown, our ranking is shown in the map on the right in shades of blue. And you can see, again, in this example, in the Rogue, areas of white are the areas that had the least opportunity for flow restoration. And a good example of this would be areas that might have very low summer flows, but there are actually no out-of-stream rights. So there are really no opportunities to put water back in stream in those basins. And then the darkest areas would be areas that had the greatest opportunity for flow restoration. So based on water availability and current uses, we did our own ranking of each basin for opportunities for flow restoration. And then in the end, we actually combined these two rankings to produce maps in each basin of the state, which represented our joint ranking effort. And so we call these high priority watersheds. These are areas that we consider to have the greatest biological need for flow restoration and watershed restoration, and the greatest opportunity for flow restoration. And so I just wanted to mention this to you because these are really the areas that we focused the majority of our Oregon Plan efforts statewide. And what you can see in this map, it basically, those areas in green show the high priority watersheds around the state as a result of this this joint effort with ODFW. And there are about 293 watersheds that we've identified statewide. This map is also provided as attachment 2 in your written testimony. And I also just wanted to mention that I've highlighted here on this map the John Day, the lower John Day basin, as just an example in blue. Each year, our water masters devise what we call an action plan for the Oregon plan. And for their water master district, they identify 4 to 5 actions that they're going to conduct under the Oregon plan in these high priority watershed areas. So, for example, in the John Day, our water master would identify some key activities for the year in those green areas that are highlighted in his district.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Thank you. You said 293 high priority watersheds that were identified?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct, 293.
And just a couple follow-up. What field are these? Are they 6th field, 5th field, do you know?
They are not, Representative Dingfelder, Mr. Chair, they actually do not correspond with any of the USGS field groupings. They're actually based on our water availability watersheds, which is really a method we use internally for making water allocation decisions. We just decided to use those for the purposes of this effort when we began in 1997, so they don't correspond well with the traditional field designation for watersheds.
Okay, thank you. Well, the question I have, two questions about that. One is, if it's in connection with the Oregon plan, my understanding is that when, through the Oregon plan, when watershed assessments are conducted, it's typically done on a 6th field or 5th field HUC. So how do you justify those if the watershed, I mean, I'm just curious, because from a hydrological standpoint, how do you correlate those two?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, it's a very good point. They don't correspond very well to the scale of the assessments that the watershed councils conduct typically, and certainly that's something for the future for us to try and reconcile these two different scales. But when we began this in 1997, it was basically some of the earliest effort to try and do some prioritization of biological needs and opportunities. So it really is an artifact from when we did this, what our existing databases were oriented toward, and for our department, it was water allocation decisions. But it certainly seems like something for the future. As we go back in at some point and work with ODFW, perhaps we need to adjust it to be more consistent with these assessment scale efforts.
Okay, thank you. And one more follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Out of these 293 priority watersheds, and the reason I ask that, because that would be a very small scale if we're looking at the major watersheds in the state, how many of those are we currently measuring water use in? In other words, I've had many discussions with your staff, Bill, and been assured that we're doing full water measurement, and I'd be curious if you can get me the information, if you don't have it on the top of your head, out of the 293 priority watersheds, how many we actually are doing water measurement, because if we're really going to promote conservation and making sure we get more water in the stream, we have to know how much we're using, which the chair knows is one of my pet peeves.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we may not be able to answer your question today, but one of our key actions that we have been conducting under the Oregon plan relates to water measurement, and so I'll be showing you some information about those efforts in just a few minutes.
Okay, thank you.
So that was just a brief overview of how we've tried to take our limited field staff in particular and focus their efforts in the areas that made the most sense in terms of the information we got from ODFW and our own information. And in those areas, we have focused on 5 measures, Oregon plan measures, which these are described in attachment 1 of your written testimony. And I'm just going to walk through these very quickly, give you a few examples of the type of activities we would conduct under each of these measures, and highlight some recent activities for you. The first measure relates to our water distribution and regulation, which is essentially a core function of our department. And in terms of the Oregon plan, the way that it plays out is our efforts to distribute water for in-stream water rights according to the priority dates of water rights on given stream. Generally, what's interesting about distributing water for in-stream water rights is that, you know, historically, we distribute water because on a stream there might be a senior out-of-stream water user who calls the water master and says, I'm not getting the water that I'm entitled to. Our water master would go out and would shut off junior water rate holders to ensure that that senior user got the water that they were legally entitled to. In the case of in-stream water rights, our water masters have to do much more enhanced monitoring of the flows in the stream so that they know if the in-stream water rights are being met according to their priority dates. So one of the key activities that we've done under the Oregon plan is try to enhance our monitoring efforts to ensure in-stream water rights are receiving the water that they're entitled to. Another key effort is related to our Water Resources Commission's water measurement strategy. And it is an effort that we call our significant diversions inventory and assessment. And I was going to just spend a few minutes describing that effort because over the last year and a half, it has been a significant portion of our Oregon plan efforts around the state. Again, in our efforts to try and focus limited resources on the issues that have the greatest impact, when we and our commission developed a strategy for increasing water measurement statewide, their policy was to major on the majors. And so that's where we developed our definition for significant diversions. And these are diversions that are either greater than 5 cubic feet per second, or they represent a large portion of the mean monthly flow, greater than 10% of the mean monthly flow. And we also included in our significant diversions definition any diversions that were already required to measure by permit condition, by condition of their existing water right. Our first step of this effort, again, we began this in about 2001, and we started with the high priority watersheds as our first starting place, because those were the areas that were most relevant to our Oregon plan and in terms of conservation and increased measurement would have the most benefit, at least as a first phase to our effort.
Talking about high priority, is this department's high priority? Then the, okay.
What I've shown in this map is the, for each water master district around the state, the number of high priority watersheds that we identified using the definition that I mentioned earlier. And when we completed the inventory, which was the first phase of this work in 2003, we identified over 3,000 of these significant diversions. We're now in the assessment phase of that process, and we hope to complete it over the next 6 months and report to our commission the results of our assessment, which is essentially going out and visiting every one of these 3,000 significant diversions to evaluate whether they're in compliance with their measuring requirements, and to also do an assessment of whether increased water measurement at those diversions would be beneficial to flows or to water management activities in the area. And so the next steps will be first to report to our commission to have them provide some recommendation for where to go from here. And but we're assuming that some of the next phases of the work will include a lot of outreach with water users and trying to help them provide technical assistance to get measurement devices or perhaps financial assistance to pay for measuring devices in those areas. Our next measure relates to fish and fish habitat protection. And I just list a few examples here of the types of activities that we take under this Oregon plan measure. And this includes things like on all new water right applications, we, working with ODFW and Department of Environmental Quality, we evaluate those new uses for potential impacts to sensitive, threatened, or endangered fish species. We also, for water right transfers, evaluate transfers for injury to existing water rights, including in-stream water rights. And we coordinate with ODFW on fish screening and fish passage requirements on new uses. Our next measure relates to promoting voluntary flow restoration, in particular those areas, those high-priority watershed areas. We also provide technical assistance to water users who are interested in converting their existing push-up dams for diverting water to fish-friendly structures. And we've worked very closely with DSL, ODFW, and landowners and have been able to replace over 60 push-up dams statewide as a result of this cooperative effort. As I mentioned, we also support voluntary stream flow restoration. We have a number of tools that we use under statute to promote flow restoration. These include in-stream leases, and that allows a water user to put their water right in-stream for up to 5 years. In-stream transfers, which allow water users to place their water right in-stream permanently or temporarily. And then also allocations of conserved water, which allow a farmer to implement a water savings on their farm, and then devote a portion of that saved water in stream and then spread the remainder onto other lands.
One of the things, Mr. Chair, that I wanted to mention here just briefly is that a piece of our legislative portfolio this session is Senate Bill 185, which has passed the Senate and I believe rests with this committee now when you choose to work it. But that bill, the purpose of that bill was to address an issue that we found with some of the folks that have wanted to lease water in stream, their primary water right in stream, but have worried about, if they did that, what would happen to their supplemental water right. Would they be accused of non-use of that supplemental water right that supplements that primary water right, which is leased in stream? And so we are going to ask you all to consider Senate Bill 185, which would actually make that the non-use of that supplemental water right an excused non-use, and so that there wouldn't be concern from the landowner end about losing that supplemental water right. So that will come when you folks are ready to entertain that legislation, Mr. Chair.
Through this combination of flow restoration tools, since the Oregon plan began in about 1997, there's been over 500 cubic feet per second restored in stream through a combination of leases, transfers, and allocations of conserved water. A majority, as you can see from this graph, have been through in-stream leases. Over 70% of the flow that's been restored has been through temporary leases. And we've found that really our success to voluntary flow restoration has been linked directly to cooperative partnerships with landowners and watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts. It's been key to our success under this program.
Before we leave there, if I could, just one of the, I think the issues that we've all heard a little bit about over time is concern about water leaving the land permanently, going back in stream. And really the success of this program has been the temporary lease program, where it's a time period for which this water is leased in stream, and then the landowner is available or able to use that water in the future if he chooses. This has proven to be a successful tool in rural Oregon. It's a lot of landowners are using this as a management tool. They're rotating their cropping patterns based on whether they want to put some water in stream and have someone compensate them for that. for a limited period of time, but still have the ability to use that water in the future. And that's one of the ways that we found that there's been a willingness in the landowner community to participate in this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil, you brought the comment you just made brings up a question for me, and something I've thought about for a long time is there, because these are voluntary and one person doesn't necessarily know what another person's doing, is there anybody that can sort of serve as a broker within the watershed to look at the whole picture? I mean, part of my frustration, having been somebody who's actually worked on watershed plans, is, you know, we don't take a holistic view. And watershed councils, to some extent, are helping do that, but I don't really think that they play the role on as far as water quantity as much. And I know we do it water quality, and we're starting to look at a more watershed approach. DEQ's got their recommendations and looking at watershed permits. So I'm thinking, is there any role that the Water Resources Department can play or the Water Master in helping look at the whole picture of the watershed and facilitate? You know, they may know of somebody who isn't necessarily using their water right now and may be willing to lease it, but they don't know about leasing options or do some exchange or transfer over here. You know, I'm really looking at how we can try to address the fact that we have so many over-appropriated basins now and low-flow situations where maybe folks just don't know of those opportunities. Can the Water Master play that role?
Mr. Chair, Representative, and Debbie can add to my answer here, but I think to some extent, certainly that's the approach we've attempted to take as we've identified the high priority watersheds where we're placing emphasis on getting water back in stream, and in cooperation with the folks who actually fund these in-stream leases, folks like the Oregon Water Trust and others. I think there is, at least to a limited extent, that kind of look occurring. Debbie, you can add to that if you like.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I think that pretty much describes it. It's relatively informal, the role that our water masters play, in that, you know, they're working under their Oregon plan measures. They're specifically trying to do outreach to landowners in those high priority areas, landowners that they think might be interested in doing flow restoration. Those are the areas where they try to do cooperative approaches and outreach with the watershed council. So it is happening, but it's in a informal way, in just our water master conducting their Oregon plan efforts.
I have a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair. About 6 months or so ago, I was on a panel for a law conference on water marketing. And my understanding is most of the water marketing that's been done has been more on the water quality side than the water quantity side, and it's starting more and more. But do you have any sense as to how successful you think? Because to me, that's one way we can address this issue, is through having a market approach. And do you have any sense if some basins you think might be more poised towards water marketing than others, and do you see that as a viable approach for Oregon?
Well, again, I'd invite Debbie to supplement my answer here, but I think there has been a limited success in regards to water marketing in the state. I think in the more urbanizing basins, we're seeing that happen. For example, the Deschutes, we're seeing more movement that direction. I think one of the issues, Representative, that we have to be alert to is the concern in the landowner community about permanently removing water from the land. And so there's been some resistance in some segments of the landowner community, the agricultural community, to aggressive water marketing. That, to me, is one of the sweet spots of this program we've been describing today, because we've been able to kind of skirt that issue by utilizing the lease rather than the permanent moving of that water. But again, that said, particularly in urbanizing basins like the Deschutes, I think there's going to be more and more interest in actual long-term water marketing. You agree?
I agree.
I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You have any measure of farm gate loss through the various and sundry things that you're talking about, programs?
Mr. Chair, I haven't sat down and worked the numbers, but let me give you the number I do have with a qualification that I may not be 100% accurate, but I think in terms of permanent transfers of water off the land, we've moved about water off about 1,500 acres statewide in the last 5 years. In terms of new water rights to land in the last 5 years, I think we've put water on about 80,000 acres. Does that sound right to you, Debbie?
Mr. Chair, that sounds about right. I do know that there are about 1.8 million existing acres, irrigated acres across the state.
So the 1,500 acres is a pretty small representation of that. And in terms, there have been many, many times that in terms of water, largely through groundwater development, mm-hmm. where we've irrigated land that has not been, has not had water on it in that manner.
Whereabouts in the state is this taking place? What parts of the state have these new groundwater resources been found?
Mr. Chair, I don't think new groundwater development is limited to any particular part of the state. I think as surface water has become fully appropriated around the state, we've seen the producer community move to groundwater. You know, one example in recent years, one significant example is the Klamath Basin, where because of the constraints on the water delivered through Klamath Lake in recent years, we've seen tremendous development of the groundwater resource there. And so that's one example, Mr. Chair, where that you could call that kind of development.
And we'll follow up on that. Are we, I assume, carefully monitoring that groundwater supply to keep check as to if and when we're lowering the aquifer level?
Mr. Chair, we are certainly attempting to do a credible job at that. Right now in the Klamath Basin, there's a significant cooperative study underway between our department and the USGS that should be completed in a year or two, that will be a comprehensive look at the groundwater situation in the Klamath Basin. We are attempting to initiate something very similar, I think, as you know, in the Umatilla Basin. Certainly funding on the state's end is a constraint right now, but we do have the USGS interested in working with us there in Umatilla County. And frankly, because of the challenges relative to our groundwater there in that part of the state, that this is something that we believe needs to go forward.
Our next measure in the Oregon Plan is to provide public outreach and education. This includes working closely, as I mentioned earlier, with SWCDs, watershed councils, landowners, to provide technical assistance on different restoration projects that they're pursuing in their watershed. We also do a number of field presentations and educational events to educate local folks about the benefits of flow restoration and other restoration projects that we work on under the Oregon Plan. A really good example of a recent effort along these lines is in Jackson County. We were able to install two new streamflow gauging stations in cooperation with the local watershed council and the Bureau of Reclamation. And as part of setting up those two gauging stations, they include an education station. And the thinking is that now that we have those two stations, we'll be able to use it for education purposes. Southern Oregon University is going to be using it, the watershed council, and also the local high schools. So that they can go out, visit the stations, get a better understanding about stream flows and flow restoration and other Oregon Plan restoration efforts. And then our last measure, again, this is one that relates to a very core function of our department, which is improving the understanding of the surface and groundwater resources of the state. And we collect data at over 200 streamflow gauging stations statewide. We have over 300 groundwater well locations that we collect data. for the purposes, for our purpose, for making water management decisions, for distributing water to things like the in-stream water right, but also the data we collect is very important to our Oregon plan partners. My last slide is just to highlight along those lines of kind of improving our understanding of the resources. We participated in the governor's recent effort to do an assessment of the Oregon plan for the coastal coho ESU. In purple, you can see the outline of the coastal coho evolutionarily significant unit shown in this map. We participated in that study led by the governor's office. Our report looked at the current impact of summer water withdrawals in the ESU. We looked at the impact of and the locations of our restoration efforts under the Oregon plan in that area. We looked at the changes, the increase in water withdrawals since the onset of the Oregon plan, and we also made some predictions about the future water withdrawals that might impact coho in the summer. Our preliminary results suggest that water withdrawals are not a major limiting factor in the coastal coho ESU, and they also showed that the areas that had the highest consumptive use, which are what is called the Mid-South Coast Monitoring Area, these areas, and the Umpqua, did have the highest summer consumptive use, but those also coincided with all of the flow restoration efforts that have been conducted under the Oregon Plan, which is a very positive result that we have been able to put water in stream in the areas that they were most needed. That concludes my slides, unless there are any other questions from the committee.
Questions? Okay. Have you gotten any, has the agency gotten any, or attempted to get any funding from OEP for any projects you might have been doing or might be looking at doing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have received OEP funding locally. Our water masters have collaborated with OEB to install stream flow gauging stations that were requested by the watershed councils. They've also funded volunteers to measure flows and which aid us in distributing water for in-stream water rights. And then they've also provided some funds to work up the stream flow records in places like the John Day, where we had a backlog of records. OEB provided money for us to contract the work, and this was, especially in the John Day, this data was very highly sought by Department of Environmental Quality and a number of other agency partners. So that's just a few examples of some of our OEB-funded projects.
Mr. Chair would like to ask you to submit for us a report on the projects where you have received OEB funding, and any projects that you might have requested funding from OEB but didn't receive them. Didn't receive that funding. And some analysis or some editorializing on those, if you would, please.
Do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dinkfelder.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up to your question, and maybe I'm just remembering wrong, I don't know, I'm getting older here. Did you not receive any Measure 66 funding the last biennium? I seem to recall that you did for some positions.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for our core budget last biennium included about $2 million of that wasn't OEB funding. I'm sorry, that was Pacific Coast money that was actually delivered, Pacific Coast salmon money that was delivered to us through OEB. And the governor's budget continues that same level of funding this time.
And what is the position? What does it fund? What positions? I know it had some link to the Oregon plan.
It does. That actually funds, Mr. Chair, Representative, 14 positions agency-wide that are all tied to the conduct of Oregon plan activities.
So, Mr. Chair, may I request just a more detailed list of those positions and what that entailed as part of their response to your question. Thank you.
We'd be happy to provide that.
We'd like to get I think some idea of how active all of the agencies are in perhaps pursuing some funding for projects that the agency feels is worthwhile as far as the Oregon plan. Certainly within each agency's own scope of practice, if I can use that type of terminology for it, they should have some better ideas for things that might help restore the species, and we'd like to make sure we're using all of your brains as well as they can be on that. So, other questions that we might have?
We've seemed to have scared off all the committee members again, Chair. We've seemed to have scared off all the committee members again.
Oh, that's true. But there are always a few faithful, so. If there's nothing else for the good of the order, we are adjourned.